Living and Working on Mars this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier, and this week to the 33rd International Space Development Conference in Southern California, where the space development community has come to share big ideas and bigger dreams. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. In a few minutes, we'll open a conversation about our future on the red planet. We've also got our usual visits with Bill Nye and Bruce Betts. Bruce will be helping me give away a Little Bits electronic space kit during this week's What's Up segment. First, though, someone who is a major participant here at the ISDC, Planetary Society senior editor and planetary evangelist, Emily Lakdawalla.
Emily, we're going to get into something that is just spectacular and right off the presses, if there's a web sense of that. First, because you talked about Rosetta last week, almost immediately after we spoke, there was a pretty interesting image development.
That's right. They published a set of images from Rosetta's OSIRIS camera, which is the main science camera on the spacecraft. It's a little early for science right now. They've been taking photos with that camera in order to better their optical navigation toward the comet. But lo and behold, they made a discovery that the comet has begun cometary activity as it approaches the sun. So in these images, a series of photos taken between March and May, you can see a tail beginning to develop, which is pretty exciting because that, of course, is exactly the kind of thing that they're going to the comet to study.
All right, let's move on to this very much hands-on entry that you have just posted at planetary.org in your blog.
It's a really cool new feature that we've just developed for the website, the ability to take a pair of images, a before and after pair, and sort of swipe in between them with the mouse. You can look at the before image and then swipe over it to look at the after image. And what I'm comparing are two self-portraits of Curiosity taken very early in the mission and one again more recently. And you can see just how much dust has accumulated on the rover's deck.
It really is fun to play with. And there is one below that, just for good measure, that is even more dramatic, showing Opportunity.
That's right. Opportunity was a very dusty rover at the beginning of 2014. The rover was almost camouflaged against the Martian soil. And then just 2 months later, the deck was quite clean. And I've heard since then, the deck has gotten even cleaner. It's almost as clean as it was when they landed. Again, this is a cool before and after comparison. You can just see how all the dust has just been swept away off of the solar panel.
So give some credit to the folks who are behind this work.
The images were of Curiosity were mosaiced by Thomas Appere, who's an amateur image processor, and he aligned them very carefully so that when you swipe back and forth between the images, it's almost as if the rover stands still. But you look in the background, you can see the rover's moved quite a lot between the two photos. And same is true for Opportunity. Those images were mosaiced by the Cornell image processing team and aligned by me.
One more thing we want to mention about Curiosity I know you're also excited about, and that is that it has finally stopped to do some more drilling.
Yes, Curiosity did just complete drilling at the Wingena site at the Kimberley outcrop, and as of the time that we're talking now, has recently driven away from the Kimberley and is on the road again to Mount Sharp.
So you can read about all of this and see the great images and play with the ones that are before and after on the blog, in the blog, planetary.org. Emily, thanks so much as always.
Thank you, Matt.
Senior editor for the Planetary Society. She is also our planetary evangelist and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Here's Bill Nye, the science guy, the CEO of the Planetary Society. Bill, got to welcome you back. We did get a very nice summary from our colleague, Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society Director of Advocacy, about what you guys were up to in D.C. last week. It was a good week, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. We went from office to office schmoozing. I'm interacting with Congress people directly, senators directly, and their staffers. As the old saying goes, Washington's a small town based on relationships. And whether or not you live in the United States, NASA is very important to space exploration writ large, worldwide. It's still three times the size of any other space agency or administration. And so we were there talking to the people that provide the funds for NASA and specifically the funds for planetary science. We met with Administrator Bolden, call me Charlie Bolden himself, along with Ellen Stofan, his chief scientist. We got everybody on board with the idea that planetary science is what NASA does best right now. It brings out the best in NASA. And so it needs to be funded at a reasonable level. And that level, we've done analysis, that level is $1.5 billion a year. And so the more people we get familiar with the Planetary Society, the easier it is to get our succinct message across. So it was a really good trip.
even as you are walking the halls there on Capitol Hill, things are deteriorating with Russia.
Is that the word, deteriorating?
I suppose it's one.
Russian-sponsored troops are in the proximity of people who lived in Crimea and Ukraine, and there's a lot of tension. Meanwhile, the United States uses Russian rocket engines. This famous RD-180 is this great engine. Kind of designing them is a bit of a dark art. And so there's a concern that not only are these engines used for taking cargo to the International Space Station, they're also used by United States firms, United Launch Alliance specifically, for military rockets. So then the Russian space agency would have the legal right not to sell them. It just shows what a tangle it can be, politics and space exploration. Man, oh man. Oh, by the way, Matt, the first thing, you're in Senator Bill Nelson's office, and he talked to us at length. You know, he's very excited to get U.S. astronauts going to the International Space Station on U.S.-built rockets. And he's focused on this. There's going to be a lot of political, maybe not maneuvering, but weight thrown around to influence the production of rockets in the United States while this unusual sort of Cold War business is going on in Eastern Europe. It's history, Matt. It's history.
Thank you, Bill, for sharing a little bit of history in the making with us.
Thank you, man.
That's Planetary Society CEO Bill Nye, the Science Guy. We're back at the International Space Development Conference, the annual celebration of space development and exploration created by the National Space Society. I've been an NSS member even longer than I've been part of the Planetary Society. This year's conference has attracted an interstellar list of movers and shakers. Some are veteran explorers and fighters for the final frontier, but it's especially gratifying to see lots of young people attending the many conference sessions. These are the faces of new space, a generation that grew up with the space shuttle and the International Space Station, with a certain knowledge that planets are the rule in the Milky Way galaxy, not the exception, with scores of interplanetary voyages by robotic explorers, and with new commercial providers of rockets and spacecraft who have set their sights on Mars and the stars. Elon Musk of SpaceX says he won't start selling public shares in that company till there are regular shuttles running between the green hills of Earth and human outposts on Mars. Now, we can admire his optimism, but getting people to the red planet, difficult as it will be, is only the beginning. With me today are guests who have thought a long time, long and hard about this challenge. Charles Wetzel and his colleagues have actually triumphed over it, at least at the level of robotic colonists. Charles heads the Mars Program Formulation Office at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the foremost explorer of that planet on this planet. Over his 25 years at JPL, he has also served as chief engineer for the Mars Exploration Program and as project systems engineer for Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory rover. Charles, welcome to Planetary Radio.
Thanks, Matt. Glad to be here.
What is the most important thing we have learned about keeping an amazingly complex device running for years and years in that very nasty environment?
I think the thing that really we have to give ourselves credit for is just testing the heck out of stuff before you send it there. Trying to think of everything that could possibly go wrong, putting everything through its paces back here on Earth, testing it to 2 times, 3 times, 4 times what you expect to see on Mars. You know, we always joke about you send these spacecraft to the Mars that you worry you're going to run into, not the Mars that you've seen before. And so we're getting smarter about understanding the environment, understanding the range of temperatures we're going to see, the range of dust we're going to see, the range of, you know, dust storms we're going to see, all those sorts of things. But it just, you know, that constructive paranoia in the back of your head says always, just dial it up one more notch and be ready. Be expecting the unexpected.
So do we need to mention that 90-day warranty once again, an opportunity still going
strong? That's probably the biggest dividend that we've gotten back in that category. And that's one where the dust and the testing both kind of went together on that. If the worst case models had been as bad as they could have been, then the 9 days really was where it was. And we didn't believe, you know, we didn't want to count on that really being the worst case. So we tested past that point. We put in extra margin beyond that point. And sometimes people forget just how much margin you've added on top of those things. But we're glad we did it, and it's really paid off in the long run.
Have these successful experiences, and we should remember, it's been a good run lately, but they weren't always so. Mars is hard. Space is hard. has it given you encouragement as we look forward to humans on Mars?
Yeah, it does. There are a lot of things. You look at how much we know about Mars today, and I definitely think it's fair to say we understand Mars a lot better today than we understood the moon when we made the commitment to send humans to the moon. And so in some ways, you know, it makes it that much easier to send people to make a commitment to send people to Mars. That having been said, it still is a lot further out there. You have to be prepared for a much longer trip out there. And there's still a lot of challenges that lie ahead. But we're gathering the information that we need. We look forward to doing larger scale technology demonstrations. There's still a lot of missions we've dreamed up that we think would be useful to send, that would be relevant to a future human spacecraft or human architectures, but wouldn't actually have people in it. That's actually one of the things we've been talking about at the conference here today. There's a lot of people who are very enthusiastic about the prospects of sending humans at least to Mars orbit, to the moons of Mars, use that as a first step, eventually down to the surface of Mars and getting them safely off of that. And there's just a lot of opportunities for cooperative robotic and human exploration going forward. We're really excited about that.
Charles Wetzel of JPL, he's going to stick around. You will, right?
I will.
Because we have a couple of other people to introduce, and then we'll all join in the conversation here at the International Space Development Conference. You know, we talk to a lot of doctors on Planetary Radio, the PhD variety. Very few of them have an MD after their names. A new member of that exclusive club is here with us at the ISDC. Susan Jewell has, you've got just about the coolest LinkedIn profile image ever. Susan is a space physician, scientist, educator, and biomedical engineer, training in survival skills, extreme environments, pilot training, because she wants to be one of those people who goes out there, maybe even one of the first on Mars. She's doing that to train for low Earth orbit, and then later, hopefully, deep space missions. Trained at NASA Johnson Space Center and the University of Texas Medical Branch, Aviation and Space Medicine Program. And she is a recipient, correct me if I'm wrong, of ESA, that's European Space Agency, scholarship to attend the International Space University. Her training as a medical scientist came from the National Institutes of Health and UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine. She's a member of the Aerospace Medical Association, the Royal Aeronautical Society, Astronauts for Hire, the Mars Society, naturally, and other outward-focused organizations. Susan Jewell, welcome to Planetary Radio.
Thank you so much, Matt. I'm really, really happy and honored for you to ask me as one of the guests on your show.
The machines that Charles has been sending to Mars are made of much more durable stuff than we humans. I suppose, though, we have the advantage of being self-repairing. And that's something you want to make sure we can continue to do on Mars?
Yeah, absolutely. I think technology and engineering, and especially now with 3D printing, stem cell, where that's advancing in medicine and in research, I think all that plays a major part in enabling us to develop the capabilities for humans to go into deep space, to survive it, and one day to, you know, really be able to colonize an off-world planet like Mars. But I do believe that we need to, you know, test bed all these ideas and concepts. And what I'm part of is part of the group of individuals who we call ourselves analog astronauts, where we literally do test, bring research projects, bring in ideas and concepts and test them in these analog simulation environments like the Mars Desert Research Station. And even recently, the NASA-funded Hawaii Space Exploration Analog Simulation there, the High Seas Project. And a lot of these analog environments is vital. And it's a place where we can not only test technology, but also the psychological aspects, the human factors, the human behavior. Because to me, I see there are a lot of challenges for humans to survive in space, in extreme environments like space. But I think one of the most limiting factors for humans to survive in space and colonize an off-world planet like Mars is the human psychology aspect.
That's MD and space medicine researcher Susan Jewell at the International Space Development Conference. Susan, JPL's Charles Wetzel, and Jeff Notkin have more to tell us about living on Mars. This is Planetary Radio.
Hi, this is Emily Lakdawalla of the Planetary Society. We've spent the last year creating an informative, exciting, and beautiful new website. Your Place in Space is now open for business. You'll find a whole new look with lots of images, great stories, my popular blog, and new blogs from my colleagues and expert guests. And as the world becomes more social, we are too, giving you the opportunity to join in through Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and much more. It's all at planetary.org. I hope you'll check it out.
Your name carried to an asteroid. How cool is that? You, your family, your friends, your cat, we're inviting everyone to travel along on NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission to asteroid Bennu. All the details are at planetary.org/BENNU. You can submit your name and then print your beautiful certificate. That's planetary.org/Bennu. Planetary Society members, your name is already on the list. The Planetary Society. We're your place in space.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan with excerpts from a conversation about living and working on Mars, recorded at the 33rd International Space Development Conference. My guests were Charles Wetzel, manager of the Mars Program Formulation Office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Doctor of Medicine and Space Medicine researcher Susan Jewell, and author, space enthusiast, meteorite man Jeff Notkin. You can hear the complete, nearly 45-minute discussion at planetary.org/radio, including why goats on Mars is a really bad idea.
Tell me about this organization which you helped to found, the ISSC. What does that stand for?
The ISSC stands for the International Space Surgery Consortium. This is an international group of surgeons and anesthesiologists and space medicine doctors that are very, very much interested in developing standard operational procedures, developing procedures and protocols to enable astronauts to survive in space when one day you can see human in space, there's going to be a high risk of injuries and even medical conditions like appendicitis or dental issues, right? What are the tools and what are the knowledge skills of the crew that will be able to address these challenges? Or what if there's a life-threatening incident, then how do we address this? So this is what we're trying to do at ISSC, is that, you know, we're trying to collaborate to work on developing these surgical procedures, medical conditions that we can address, and then teach.
I want to bring one more person into this conversation, someone with extensive experience in some of the most extreme environments that our home world offers. As far as I know, he's also the only person with us today who actually owns a piece or two of Mars. Jeff Notkin hosted the award-winning television adventure series Meteorite Men for the Discovery Network Science Channel, but you've probably seen him on nearly every other major media outlet. He also works with some of our planet's most distinguished museums, sharing his love of space rocks and science. His company, Aerolite Meteorites, sells space rocks and shares his lifelong love of these interplanetary voyagers and the science that they represent. He's also a photographer, a writer, and right over here are his two books. There's one, Rockstar, Adventures of a Meteorite Man, which I can recommend very highly. It's a great read. And this one, which came first, right? Meteorite Hunting, How to Find Treasure from Space. Pretty cool stuff. He's also a designer and a recovering punk rocker. Please welcome Jeff Notkin.
Thank you, Matt. It's great to work with you again. And let me say, there is no full recovery from punk rock, but you know, we do the best that we can. You know, the first thing that came to mind after Susan's extraordinary introduction that you gave her and her many credits is, I wish I'd had you on some of our expeditions to some of these scary places. You sound like you have exactly the kind of expertise we need to keep my guys in one piece.
Well, and, I was a rock singer, so maybe there was something.
Yeah, we're also...
We got two rockers here.
I know.
Charles and
I
are the outsiders, unfortunately. We'll come to your concert. You've spent time in some of these extreme environments. I'm thinking of the section in your book, Your First Trip to the Atacama Desert, where you might have ended up out there as a fossil if you hadn't gotten that truck out of the sand.
Indeed. Actually, perhaps mummy would be more accurate than fossil. It was really, there were several very close calls. And I think when you're operating in environments that are this harsh and this difficult, potentially hazardous, you really have to try and prepare for every possible eventuality. And it doesn't matter because there will always be something else that goes wrong. As Douglas Adams said in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, expect the unexpected. And we had the best vehicles, the best survival equipment, and you'll recall this passage in Rockstar where we're driving our four-wheel drive vehicles across just hard, flat, desert pavement, looking for meteorites, and our truck just sank into a pit of talcum powder fine sand right up to the axles. And you can't really predict that sort of thing. And I've spent several months in the Atacama Desert, northern Chile, on multiple expeditions, and you do feel like you're in an alien world. And you can see why Nomad was tested there, why Fido was tested there. When you're out hiking across that wasteland with the low rolling hills and the red sand and the broken rocks and absolutely nothing else, no cacti, no insects, no reptiles, with a little exercising of the imagination, you could put yourself on Mars. And it's a very exciting experience, and it's also a bit worrying. And I think one of the things we have to think about with our astronauts and our colonists who will hopefully eventually take this trip before too long is that they should be prepared psychologically for the shocking devastation that exists out there. And for a few days, I found it amazing. I go, well, look, there's not anyone. You couldn't see a car. There were no telegraph poles. There aren't even aircraft that fly over. It is that remote. And after time, it can become disturbing. And there are some people who have been on the ANSMET meteorite recovery expeditions to Antarctica who have experienced depression and negative reactions because of the desolation and the sameness of the environment. So I entirely agree with Susan that perhaps giving these colonists and future astronauts the opportunity to experience these environments, similar environments here on Earth before they go, even if that maybe means building similar temporary Mars bases and
habitats,
and operating, practicing, using spacesuits in that environment, because that's a difficult terrain to climb over, and no matter how careful you are, you'll take a fall now and then, you get flat tires, things go wrong, and falling here when you're hunting for space rocks is one thing. Falling on Mars in a spacesuit, in a pressure suit, could be a completely different experience.
We have been talking with Mars explorer and engineer Charles Wetzel of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, with space medicine pioneer Susan Jewell, Dr. Susan Jewell, and the meteorite man, Jeff Notkin. Our thanks also go to the National Space Society, producer of the 33rd International Space Development Conference, led by ISDC Chair Pat Montour and co-chairs Nicola Sarzi-Armati and John Spencer. We're also grateful to Mike Coburn for his support. Bruce Betts in this week's edition of What's Up, our next.
It is time to talk to the Planetary Society's Director of Science and Technology, that's Bruce Betts, who I'm sorry to say, Guy, that you weren't able to join us for ISDC. It was fun.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it and sorry I missed it.
You know, you had to be preparing to tell us about the night sky. So what do we have to look up to?
Exactly. That's all I've been doing for days and days. What you have to maybe look up to is a possible new meteor shower, or even meteor storm with hundreds or even thousands of meteors per hour. Probably not, but maybe. So here's the deal. On May 24th, Saturday early morning, so the evening, that's Friday night, Saturday morning, the Earth will cross through debris from the small comet P209 Linear. Now, this comet got perturbed in its orbit, got changed and tweaked by a pass a little too close to Jupiter a couple years ago, and that's why now there's a orbital debris train, which we're crossing into. But it's almost anyone's guess how much stuff we'll actually run into. So it could range from ones of meteors, tens of meteors, hundreds, or maybe thousands. It favors North America, and so you might want to give it a shot early Saturday morning.
It sounds like a gamble worth taking.
Then there's our usual crowd, quite reliable, less spectacular in some ways, but some ways just as spectacular. We've got Jupiter in the evening sky over in the west. We've got Mars up in the south looking reddish, Saturn over farther to the east, and in the pre-dawn still Venus. And you may even be able to catch Mercury in the early after sunset low in the west. We move on to this week in space history. Hard to believe it, but it was already 2008, looking back 6 years ago, that Phoenix landed on Mars and began its successful Mars surface mission.
Before you go in to Random Space Fact, I have to admit an error, which I don't know if you discovered, but I bet a lot of people in the audience wondered why we said Tom Jones was our celebrity Random Space Fact introducer, and he didn't show up. Well, that was my fault. I forgot to stick his voice in there. So sorry about that. So here, for real, is Tom Jones, the astronaut.
Hi, Bruce. It's planetary scientist and astronaut Tom Jones, and I think it's about time for a random space fact.
All right, Tom. Sorry about that.
Yay. Did you know, Matt, they're estimated to be 7 times 10 to the 22nd stars in the universe. That's 70 sextillion stars in the universe, and I've counted about half of them.
That's good.
That is not true. It is not an exact number either, but that is does give you the scale of, hey, there are a lot of stars in the universe.
Yeah, there really are. And I was ready to believe that you had counted half of them, and that's why you weren't at ISTC.
Yes, I was also doing that. By the way, this is to be contrasted with seeing only a few thousand stars in the night sky with the naked eye, even from the darkest sight. So we not surprisingly see just a wee bit of a tiny fraction. All right, we go on to the trivia contest. Measured across the Earth's surface, how far did Alan Shepard travel in Freedom 7, the first American in space suborbital flight? How'd we do, Matt?
Boy, big response to this. I suspect because a whole bunch of people wanted to win this Little Bits space kit, this electronics kit, this particular one developed in cooperation with NASA. It's been seen on TED. It's really pretty fun. I've got one here that I think I still have to send to Bill Nye. We'll see when I get around to that. It's really too much fun. Our winner. Okay, folks, don't come down on me for this. This is random.org, and he is no relation. I can't help how this came out. Our winner is David Kaplan of West Simsbury, Connecticut.
I was afraid you were going to say that Matt Kaplan was the winner, so that doesn't seem nearly as bad.
He is absolutely not a relation. He's just a faithful, good listener, and his number came up. So, David, you're going to get the Little Bits kit. And, you know, stay tuned. We're not going to give away one this week, but we might just have another pretty soon. So there will be another opportunity. And we won't let David win. How's that?
Okay.
And by the way, it was, according to most people, about 302, 303 miles that Alan Shepard traveled downrange, more than twice as far as he went up.
Indeed. 486 kilometers. So not that far.
Yeah.
From Southern California doesn't even get us up to my hometown of Sacramento. All right, let's move on to the next trivia contest question. We in the Milky Way galaxy are part of what's called the local group of galaxies. Two biggest galaxies by far are the Milky Way and the Andromeda Galaxy. What is the third largest galaxy in the local group? Go to planetary.org/radio contest. Get us your entry.
You have until the 27th, that would be Tuesday, May 27, at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer. I don't know the answer. I only know that the local group rules.
Local group rules! All right, everybody, go out there, look up at the night sky, and think about if you were king of something, what would it be? Thank you, and good night.
Why, the local group, of course.
Why stop there?
Today, the local group. Tomorrow, the multiverse. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by the Ready for Mars members of the Society. Clear, pink skies,